Hi folks, and welcome to Mad Scientists of Music. This is a series about Irish experimental musicians at home and abroad, and this is the second of our bonus episodes. In episode 5 of the series, we examined copyright in Ireland as it pertains to music, and this episode goes into a lot more detail. We didn't have space in the main episode to talk about Creative Commons, about patent law, about mashups, so this interview-only episode will get into a lot of those issues. I hope you enjoy it. To start off with, here's what our interviewees had to say about Creative Commons. If you haven't heard of the Creative Commons licensing scheme, here's how it's described by Ciarán Dald, also known as Cara Cara.
Lawrence Lessig's very earnest attempt to try and make copyright reform within copyright laws.
Still in the dark? Well, here's a few of the potential uses of these licenses. If you want to let people share and use your photographs, but not allow companies to sell them. Suppose you'd like it if listeners to your music or viewers of your movie share it as long as they give you credit. Or if you want to find and use sound effects, samples and music for programs like this one without necessarily being able to afford to pay a charge. Often the creators of such sound effects and music will allow them to be used so long as the final product isn't sold for a fee. Or if, like this show, it can be chopped up and given away in turn. Here's Andrew Edgar.
For chiptune and indeed circuit band music, an awful lot of it is released on Creative Commons, or released through net labels, through whatever sort of free licensing models. And I think that's probably been instrumental in letting it grow to be a global phenomenon.
Trinity College Law Professor and Chair of the recent Copyright Review Committee, Dr. Owen O'Dell.
Where something is released on Creative Commons, the primary thing that the artist wants in those circumstances is recognition. Attribution and share alike is the usual things that they want. They want, if Timbaland is taking my music and I've made it available in Creative Commons, he can use it provided he gives me credit. It's the lack of the credit that is the real problem there, not necessarily the lack of the payment. If it wasn't made available on Creative Commons or equivalent license, if it was copyright content, then not only is it the lack of content, but it's also the permission and the finances there.
While Owen has a point about many artists being happy to have their work used, it's also not necessarily true that artists who release their work on Creative Commons don't demand a fee or would be happy to have it used without compensation. In fact, Creative Commons licenses specifically allow you to decide the circumstances under which your work will be shared. One artist who's given away much of his work for free in the past as Creative Commons tracks is Ewan Henley.
I'm not really an audiophile, so I never really go looking for high quality versions of things. If I'm downloading stuff, it will be from net labels a lot of the time. Because I tend to listen to things that my peers are making. You know, the last couple of releases I really enjoyed have been put up on YouTube by the artists or the label themselves. So I've actually just been listening to them on YouTube. And I think people will just, if they hear that, they'll probably sneer and think I'm an idiot. But I'm able to go and listen to it anywhere I want. So I go to someone's house and go, well, check this out, and it's on YouTube, you know.
Many of the artists interviewed for this series do make use of Creative Commons licenses, but not all are so keen. Here's Mel Joanne.
Ewan, under his Herve moniker, released a load of stuff to Creative Commons. Like, a lot of net labels use it and that. I don't have strong feelings on it, really. I think, for myself, I like the kind of illusion of control that you have with not using Creative Commons. If it was used in a context that I found dodgy politically, that would be upsetting. Then again, most people that know what Creative Commons is are not going to be dodgy politically, so you're probably fine. But then again, when I'm dead, I won't care, so it's nice to think that it would all revert into the public domain.
Mashup artists like John Leach and Ciarán Dald use samples from copyrighted albums to produce their work. While their work is original, some argue that it should only be possible where it has industry support, since it relies so heavily on the creative work of others. Here's John Leach.
We've all invested in the Beatles. We've all paid our dues over the years through advertising revenue from radio stations. The Beatles have made their money. Let's just let the songs be there. We'll take Girl Talk, who is a mashup artist, who you can open up the album sleeve and the record label is Illegal Art. Every track that's sampled listed, and it's each record label is named out after it and copyright 2000 and whatever. I can only assume that they're paying their dues. This is a little bit sickening to think, where's all that going? It's going into the costs of actually having a massive team of lawyers mapping out who owns what, who do we pay for this, who do we owe that, oh yeah, I gotta pay this guy for the phone call I made to him for 20 seconds yesterday. And I mean, sure, look, you know, there's got to be some kind of currency, you know, you got to eat, right? But when there's too many hands kind of dipping into the pot and it just becomes a farce, it takes away from the whole aim of sitting down and writing a song or sitting down and mixing two songs together to kind of come up with a new kind of a vibe.
In fact, John's wrong about this. I looked into it and Girl Talk does not pay for any of his sample clearance. And although his records have been very successful online, he's never been sued either. Many speculate this is because the recording industry are terrified that a court might rule in his favour, finding his work, in fact, fair use, due to the transformative way in which the samples are employed. One mashup artist who wasn't so lucky was DJ Danger Mouse, whose incredibly innovative Grey album faced legal threats.
So when Danger Mouse released the Grey album, which was a mashup between Jay-Z's Black album and the Beatles' White album, he took the songs from the Beatles' White album, cut them up and made them into hip-hop beats, and then he took the vocals from Jay-Z and put them over it, called it the Grey album. And Apple, of course, as we know, stomped down on it straight away because it wasn't in their interests to have their copyrighted material bastardized, for want of a better word. Of course, Danger Mouse wasn't releasing it to make money because he knew he couldn't make any money from it, but it was already disseminated out into the internet and everybody had it. One of the most downloaded records that year. Could have made a fortune for Apple if they had played the cards right, but no, they wanted to fight art. They lost out on a lot because of that.
However, while Danger Mouse did find his Grey album and his subsequent release, Dark Night of the Soul, hidden from public view and legally prohibited from being sold, he did benefit from creating the albums. Here's Colin Mulwell.
Danger Mouse did extraordinarily well out of it. That album was almost the beginning of Pirate Bay culture. That came in, what's that now, 10 years ago it must be? He may have been sued about it, but like I don't think he took much consequence and he didn't make any money. I think he released a version redone somehow. But, you know, I think he established his reputation. And that's maybe a good illustration that remix culture isn't so much about making money. That's a different matter. It's about establishing reputations and getting known. The 90s bootleg 12 inches, that's all long gone. You know, unless you're paid to do a remix, unless you're, you know, Diplo or somebody doing it, you know, and then you have permission. And the non-permissioned one, as I say, doesn't make money, really. So bootleg culture as a money-making thing is long gone. So I don't see much of a problem there.
I know guys like Too Many DJs probably pay their dues, probably negotiations through labels. But I mean, it's like if you want to sample something and put it into something else, there's a difference between blatantly ripping off somebody's work and actually reworking it or paying tribute and homage to something rather than just stealing an idea. And then fundamentally, can you steal an idea? Like, I mean, how do you catch the devil by the tail? Like, it's not possible, really, is it? Like, it's not tangible.
One of the more recent pop culture copyright controversies surrounded the viral hit, The Harlem Shake. Here's Ed Devan.
Do you know that song, Do the Harlem Shake? The guy who sampled two reggaeton records, these two obscure musicians that weren't even active anymore, and became the biggest YouTube hit ever, and then suddenly these guys who he'd sampled were looking for their money, you know, because the record label had assumed that it wouldn't become. How could you predict something being watched a billion times? They didn't clear the samples, or they just took the guy on his word that he had cleared them.
The way that this issue was dealt with rubbed another mashup artist, Kieran Dald, up the wrong way.
The Bauer and Harlem Shake thing kind of shows the true nature of intellectual property law, which is the law only applies when something's successful. A law should not be that circumstantial. If you're going to do something like that, it should be across the board, or else you're not standing by your convictions. I'd be more willing to listen to anyone who defends intellectual property in its current form, I should say, if they believed it should be applied across the board.
We all have a soundtrack in our heads to our late teens or our early adulthood. Key songs that you'll hear, I'm just a teenage dirtbag or some shit. You just remember where you were when that came out. So in a way, we all own a piece of those songs.
Plenty of countries exist without copyright laws in place, and they're doing fine. I'm curious to see how they work out, because you have India, which is removing its patent law because German pharmaceutical companies were charging way too much for medicine they desperately needed. Brazil has removed its copyright law pretty much and its intellectual property law because, again, the US was charging way too much for HIV medication, which was mainly being sourced from Brazilian ingredients. And Brazil were just like, we know how to make it ourselves, stop our people from dying. And now, because of that, they have a minister of arts and entertainment who encouraged remixing classes after school in primary school. He hopped on this and he made a culture of DJs and Prague funk, I think is what it's called, which is basically just sampling. You have China, who agrees with international copyright law, but don't obey it in any way, shape or form, and they're still making lots of money hand over fist.
This may in fact be an oversimplification. Recent Indian legal decisions have reversed the country's historic stance on allowing domestic drug companies to generically reproduce the expensive medications produced by international conglomerates. Meanwhile, in Brazil, the fearsome-sounding National Council on Combating Piracy and Crimes Against Intellectual Property are making it more and more difficult for domestic users to engage in the kind of piracy that's no longer tolerated in Europe and America. These changes, however, don't tell us what's right or wrong. They only tell us how powerful intellectual copyright organizations like the World Intellectual Property Organization have become. Most musicians I've spoken to don't actually feel that this is how music should be protected or controlled, and that it doesn't help them as creators to have laws in place and punishments which criminalize copyright violation.
Things like watermarking CDs and watermarking DVDs, it's horrible. The idea that you can buy a computer game and you can't loan it to your friend, they can't have it play in their machine, this sort of stuff, it's just nonsense. You can't abide it, really. This is often said, but information wants to be free, so let it be free.
My idea would be reduce the amount in which copyright holds on for. I think it's great that original artists have an embargo on their work, but that needs to run out within their lifetime. If you want any genuine incentive for artists to create more, that has to run out in their lifetime.
We incentivize the production of the copyright work or the patented invention or whatever, not just because we think in terms of the property rights of the inventor or the copyright owner, but for more general social reasons, that there are good social benefits from the production of the copyright work. And therefore, we can take more general social goods into account in determining the existence and the nature and extent of copyright and copyright protection and so on.
14 years was the original. And 14 years, I think, is enough time to make money. I think any movie studio, record company would agree, if your product's not making money from 14 years after it was first released, it's never going to make money.
I think it's very unlikely that any copyright creator is incentivized by abnormally long copyright terms. I'm unconvinced by arguments to extend copyright terms. And as I say, I think we've gone perhaps a little further than we should.
I think 80 years is a long time. I think 20 years is even a long time. I'd even think 10 years is a long time. You know, I think maybe 10 years might be a more reasonable figure. If I released the greatest song in the world tomorrow, like, and it gets played on the radio for 10 years and people buy the album and all that, and if I get 10 years out of it, I would be happy enough to kind of turn around and say, okay, do what you want with it then after that.
Maybe people who aren't artists have this very glorified idea of how art comes about, because if artists needed money to incentivize their work, then no art would get made, because no artist, definitely nowadays, becomes a success overnight. There's years of making art with no one listening, no one watching, no one reading. We're now heading towards a kind of corporate stranglehold. IPA, the Pacific Trade Agreement, that came out and basically revealed that it's going to make, within the agreeing countries, copyright reform illegal, and it's just going to keep copyright the way it is, with the perpetual copyright idea. If you're going to lessen the power of intellectual property law, you have to increase the power of labor laws. But I am not a lawmaker. I'm just someone who this law would apply to. And I think it should get changed because I don't think it's working at the best right now. I think the biggest argument is most copyright law does not account for the internet. Common household feature since the late 90s.
In Ireland, the changing state of copyright law and how it's impacted by technology has recently been examined by the Copyright Review Committee.
There needs to be something more than the list of iterated exceptions, because otherwise copyright law will keep falling behind. We're about to make our reforms to meet our current social requirements. Copyright is one of those areas of the law where once we understand the social consequences and the technological consequences, we can see that the law is not keeping up with society and technology. We have to wait to see whether the broader perspectives that the reform bodies have proposed or the sectoral interests of the various bigger companies that have the ear of government will prevail.
Irrespective of how the law changes in Ireland or internationally, the reality is that the music industry as we knew it is largely gone. The days when a small artist who'd hoped to make a living from infrequent releases of albums promoted by tours or really historical, and artists in their absence have had to develop new ways of financing their careers. One proposal supported by some is a media tax, whether it be on computers, on use of the internet, or on the mediums themselves that we use to store information.
Apple, Google, and every bloody body else should be taxed to the hilt, because people these days pay for their computers and their broadband. Some pay for maybe a Spotify account, which is risible, frankly, to me, the amount of money that's spent on that kind of thing. So taxation would be the only way to do it. I don't see that happening soon, if ever.
Such a proposed tax might be less far-fetched than it at first appears. Many countries adopted media charges when video cassettes became available on tapes in the 1980s, and Ireland has proposed a household media charge, which would be broader than the current TV licence and may come in as early as next year. Such a charge would vastly increase the revenue taken, because every household, not just those who have or admit to having a TV, would have to pay it. While it's obvious that such flat taxes impact the poor far more than the wealthy, it's also true that they do provide an additional revenue scheme. And in Ireland, the current TV licence helps independent producers to produce radio programmes like this one. It remains to be seen just how the incomes of such a tax would be divided up between the hungry music, TV and film industries. For now, independent artists are largely on their own, having to find innovative new ways of financing their existence.
At the same time, you can see where people are coming from with being afraid of losing out on sales. But with a lot of people that are producing independent music, their own music, a lot of them are giving their music away for free, and they're not making millions a year on their music, probably not making anything on their music, and they're giving it for free. Or even to allow people to choose what they pay. Like on Bandcamp, you can pay this much, or you can pay more if you want to pay more. Radiohead did it as well, where they allowed people to choose how much do you want to pay for that album. And it worked, because some people might have more money, but someone who's really broke and is really a big fan of that band can actually afford to pay a couple of euros if they want to pay €3 for the album, or they can pay €20 for the album.
I've gone away from making something that a DJ would play in a club to something that is a lot harder to actually capture in a recording. It's not a backlash against recorded music as such, but I think recorded music is there. It's a form of the art to take and to use, but I don't want the recording to be everything about the music that I make, which is why I'm spending more time coming up with either equipment that people can use collaboratively or just sharing ideas that people can work on for me. Just making it more interesting, like, than just spending a month producing a track, and it's just a molecule in the ocean of tracks that are being published, and does anybody listen to them? There's probably more people making tracks than there are listening to them. Whereas at least if I'm building community, I guess, through, you know, as small as it may be, like through collaborating with people who I haven't worked with before, they have their own network of friends that they'll tell people about, oh yeah, I'm working on this project. And if it's good, then they'll share it. And it's kind of a more grassroots way of sharing what I do on my own terms, rather than being reliant on a label or just the general way that people consume music.
In the absence of a market for music, many have argued that music actually has become instead a promotional tool, with merchandise and touring being the sources of revenue that artists will have to rely on in the future. But is piracy a promotional tool? Is it possible that criminalising and reducing piracy can actually make it more difficult for an artist to promote their work?
In relation to piracy, I think that one positive thing about it is that it does expose your music to a huge range of people. You've got a far wider fan base because of that.
The people that are really sensitive to it are, again, always the big companies. They're the ones that are more sensitive about people downloading. And I think it's really nice when you see someone like, I think it was like David Bowie, all up for people downloading his music, because he was saying that other people are going to hear it. So if they download it, they're going to be listening to it. Therefore, their friends are going to listen to that. And then when that band comes to play a concert, more people are going to go and see it, because the music has been given more exposure. Because there's so much music out there that it's hard for everybody to be able to buy every piece of music that you want to buy, especially for younger teenagers and stuff that want to actually get into particular music. a lot of new artists now, when they put up an album, they might give one or two of the tracks for free just to promote it. So that then, if you like that track, you might go and buy the album then. And sometimes I find, even when I've downloaded stuff, I might go and buy the album.
The exact question, is piracy advertising? I don't know. You've stumped me. I think that payment methods, business models, ease of use will create a legal ecosystem which will largely overtake a lot of the existing piracy. It's a pretty common observation that people go for free because it's easy. But there are lots of downstream problems associated with free which you tend not to get with proper licensed products. And I think that the advertising that you currently get from piracy, you'll just get from more usual and legitimate systems according as the business models develop and mature. We're still in very early days. Spotify in 5 years' time will not look like Spotify now. It didn't exist 5 years ago. The business models will develop, the music industry and the music itself will mature. Technology itself will provide a lot of the solutions to the challenges that technology is currently creating. Because a lot of the problems and a lot of the issues and a lot of the solutions are technological, not legal.
Copyright law also concerns patents. Some of the musicians and inventors we interviewed in the series developed their own apps or physical instruments and technologies, and their views on patents are quite interesting. Here's musician and instrument builder Ed Devan.
In a way, the work I'm doing now, which is more about inventing physical objects, it's more of a concern to me than somebody using some of my music without permission. I don't want to invent something and then have somebody else steal that idea. Patenting things is actually quite a expensive process. Very expensive, actually, if you want to do it on a worldwide scale. You really need a lot of money behind you.
Here is Simon Kenny, developer of the Oscar app.
We went to a patent lawyer with the app. The university, NUMNews, set it up for us and we didn't have to pay for it. So we thought, why not? We'll go and see what happens. So as the code architect or as the software engineer, I thought I knew that there was no patent in it. All of this stuff's been done before. It's all well known. We're just putting it together in a unique way. So I thought at best there'll be a patent for it the way that we've put it together. We went to this patent lawyer and he told us that that's not a patentable thing. But actually I was really happy that there was no patent in it. I really didn't want there to be a patent because I didn't want to be someone who has a patent. For me, it's morally objectionable. It's such a confusing area. I didn't want to stop someone else from using things that we had. I thought it would be a false claim that something that I had done was that worthy of being protected so aggressively, you know? The other guy that I work with this app is, he's the designer of the app in general, you know, it's his idea. I'm just the engineer. So he came up with the way that we interpret the swipes and all the rest. We're on the same page with this stuff. But we still went for it. I didn't feel good about it. Honestly, I didn't feel good about even going. I suppose in general, it's pretty obvious that I'm contradicted about the whole thing. On the one hand, it's like someone saying, there's a chance that you could make money on something that you've already done. All you need to do is come into this room and we'll talk about it and we'll sort it out for you. And that seemed tantalizing, making money from your work, which is great. It's in a way, though, that I don't like. So I'd like to think that I would have not agreed to take a patent if there was one. But honestly, I probably would have taken one. Would probably have been something that I would have regretted. So that's why I'm saying that I'm glad that it didn't happen. One of the reasons that I have moral problems with patents and copyright, in order for something to be copyrighted, it has to go by the laws of the country. The US is different than the UK, and I mean, they're all similar, but there can still be a significant small point that makes a big difference in what's allowed. How long does a copyright live, and when can you do this, or who owns it under what circumstances? As long as you're the first person to implement it in a technological field, you know, maybe that's not fair, but that's the law, right? So in a political system where laws get made all the time, as a direct consequence of corporate lobbying, then you can get situations where you can do things legally that are morally wrong, and only the people who are interested in it could possibly agree to these things, like the Monsanto seeds. It's really contentious. That's why I'd prefer to keep myself as distant as possible from copyrights and patents, because they only rest on laws which don't necessarily reflect what I would consider to be right.
So that's it for our copyright bonus episode. Once again, thank you so much to all the musicians and to Dr. O'Nodell for agreeing to participate in the interviews that made up this program and the rest of the programs in the series. There are so many issues around copyright that certainly a couple of half-hour programs aren't going to do it justice. But if you really are interested in copyright law in Ireland, I'd recommend reading the report of the Copyright Review Committee chaired by Owen O'Dell. That's called Modernising Copyright, and it's linked from the website of this radio show, which is garethstack.com. That's where you'll also find the 6 main episodes in this series, as well as the rest of the web only episodes. So still to come are 2 more episodes, one episode which covers nerd culture in Ireland and one more episode about Irish musical scenes. Plus, once I can figure out how to do it and get around to it, I will be putting up all of the individual interviews that comprise the series, and that includes many, many interview clips that didn't make any of the final episodes. So thanks for listening to this episode, and apologies for my hay fever inflicted vocals.